Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below. After centuries of oppression, violence and genocide, could some healing and regeneration come from a baby food company? We explore that impossible question today, where we touch upon many things: the role of farming and stewarding the land in the Navajo Nation, and the role of nutrition and health with newborns. Join me in a fascinating conversation, which I'm very sorry for the audio quality, which was very, very difficult to manage this time. I hope you can listen through it and enjoy the depth and feel the potential of healing centuries of horror, one step at a time. First step, baby food. What are the connections between healthy farming practices, healthy soil, healthy produce, healthy gut, and healthy people? Welcome to a special series where we go deep into the relationship between regenerative agriculture practices that build soil health and the nutritional quality of the food we end up eating. We unpack the current state of science, the role of investments, businesses, nonprofits, entrepreneurs, and more. We're very happy with the support of the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment for this series. The Grantham Foundation is a private foundation with a mission to protect and conserve the natural environment. Find out more on granthamfoundation.org or in the links below. Welcome to another episode. Today with Zachary Ben from the Navajo Nation, co-founder alongside with his wife Mary of BD Baby Foods, organically grown, Navajo-owned and indigenous baby food line created by farmers and new parents to increase access to traditional foods in early childhood. Welcome, Zach.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And to start with a personal question that we always love to ask at the beginning is, how did you end up focusing on soil, and in this case, of course, baby food, but what led you, how was your journey nudged or pushed or pulled, I don't know which one of the three, into focus on soil?
Yes, I think for me, it's something that was a foundation that was provided for me by my parents, by my father especially. I am a sixth generation farmer here on the Navajo Reservation. I grew up farming. I grew up playing in the ditches, playing in the waterways, and, you know, understanding the land in that sense at a very young age. And so for me, it was really about, you know, being able to be synchronized with your environment at a very young age. And being in sync allowed me to understand the soil health, the effects of continuously growing year after year consecutively, and what that can do to your soil health, and being able to nurture the land and steward it as humans are intended to do so. And this is something that was taught to me through Navajo philosophy, and being able to have that relationship to the land and being able to have that connection of, you know, what you extract, you put back in. And so that's kind of how I grew up with those values and practices, and am now being able to then teach that to our current youth and our children. My wife and I have two kids, and, you know, with that, you know, being able to have that foundation be laid upon them, so that way they can use that to continue to heal, to continue to provide food for their communities and ceremonies, and have that relationship ultimately with the land.
Yeah, and thank you for coming on, because I know it's a very busy time with a recent newborn. So congrats with that. We know the boat, let's say. We know the busyness. But what triggered that from, I mean, you're farming the land for a long time and your family has been farming the land for a long time, but it still is quite a step to setting up a baby food brand. Like that's quite a, because if you're farming well, you can provide for your family and for your children, and maybe also a few let's say, circles around you. But setting up a baby food brand is a whole different ball game and a whole different game in general. So what triggered that to take that step?
Yeah, I think for me, taking those major steps was inspiration. Yeah, so for us, a lot of the inspiration came from our children. And when we first found out that we were pregnant, I think, that's huge news. That's also a way of like understanding the growth into parenthood. And so for us as providers, as parents, as farmers, what would that be? What would that next crucial next step be? And that was understanding like the ability to have this food available for only ceremonies or celebrations and not readily available for where it's like always in your pantry. And so from that to also, understanding like, it's kind of funny because during this time was the pandemic time. And for us, we felt like, and seeing and experiencing food shortages that were happening around the world. And we felt like, this is something that, why are we struggling when we have our own crops to manage and maintain? And, why would we have to rely on the current food system, which is very unstable, to provide for our family? Also, the instability of the nutritional intake that we're looking for. With that nutritional intake, you're also your intake is chemicals, and the chemical processes and the preservatives that go into the food just to have it in quotes fresh delivered to your door or local supermarket. Why as us as indigenous people have to rely on Sam Walton to provide food for traditional food or baby food for our children. So all of this was hitting us at once. And we felt like, okay, it's up to us. It's up to us to make that next big step. And that started by producing our own crops using our own heritage seeds. We don't use any type of herbicides or pesticides in our processes and practices. And so that's what really, propelled us in that direction, knowing that we have this traditional food that we can rely on and fall back on, and most importantly, provide for our babies. And so, that's where we were able to then really move forward in that direction of like this first year's crop on our own is for our family. And from there, that's when, after planting that first year's crop and our son was eating those crops that we harvested, that fruit of that labor that we provided all year, that reaction was something that we wanted for the rest of our communities. When he took that first bite of food that we provided as parents and as farmers, that was the next big step. That is what we needed for our communities, and that's how it started, through the growth of parenthood, through those changes that we go through as parents. Mom goes through these biological changes, spiritual changes, physical changes, and for myself as a father, I wanted to also be a part of those changes into that direction of what it means to be a father. And so with that, you're breaking cycles of trauma, intergenerational, historical, and being able to start healing here and now using that farm as that foundational, and being able to move forward in a direction that you are starting to build generational wealth using these crops and providing those fruits of labor to your children. So that's how it was inspired, and how we're able to now build this momentum.
And then where do you start? I mean, you start obviously by planting and harvesting and providing for your, at that time, son, your only child. Of course, now they're two. But then how does that evolve into or emerge into a brand with different products? What's the next step to think about processing, or what was it very clear from the beginning what you wanted to be the first products or the first things, let's say, on shelf, quote unquote, to be sold? Or did it also emerge over time?
So we did our research. We looked into all the available traditional foods related to early childhood development and nutrition. And there was that.
And you were pretty disappointed, or not?
Yes. Yeah. We were surprised. And that was also a major motivator into you know, increasing that market access and outlets to our own, you know, farm. And that was something that we felt like was needed and is going to be needed for not only our children, but more children to come. And more children that are being created every day and born every day. And those are things that we felt like, wow, you know, let's start this company in order to provide for our children and grow this this love and provide that. So in this, because we're going to need that for healing after the pandemic and being able to move in that direction, that we can use this to heal our communities as we have done within our ceremonies.
And so now we're talking September 2023. How would you describe the food company? How would you describe where you are now in terms of offering and what it means and what is currently the baby food company? What shape or form you would describe it?
I think for us, we're in a very unique position here on the Navajo Reservation, because when we farm using our own natural resources. And so with that position, we're able to also, we shed a lot of red tape, basically, because the land that we farm on, we sit on land, the agricultural land use permits that are given to us by the Navajo government, which is then leased from the U.S. government. And so with all of that oversight, there is no policy that will help us to move in that direction that, you know, we can fully create economic stability on a farm. And I say that in regards to infrastructure, like, for example, food storage, dry and cold. We cannot build a permanent infrastructure on our agricultural land use permit, nor do we own it. So if we don't own it and we invest, for example, $1 million into a facility, commercial kitchen, processing, food processing area, storage, both cold and dry, all the necessary equipment, the brick and mortar parts, logistics of that, we won't own. And so, you know, those are things and types of barriers that we see. And using our momentum of who we are in order to then tackle down or amend a lot of those policies into our favor as a small business, as an agricultural business, as an entrepreneur, and being able to move forward in those directions. And so from that to being able to look at the success and achievements of our, you know, company, the past year, last year, we've sold and provided food to over 6,000 children. And we look to double that number this year, this harvest season. And so that in itself is a huge accomplishment out of 15 acres of farmland. And so for us, we rely heavily on our community. And those are things that we're teaching our community now, that we're able to bring education and awareness into why healthy traditional foods are important for our diet. So that way we can prevent a lot of the health limits related to food, because Navajo Nation is one of the highest rates of type 2 diabetes in the country. And so what we're doing is we're looking at a social return on investment by being able to read into the children that we're feeding now. And that is each child that is fed Bitty Baby Foods now has, you know, the ability to prevent those cycles of health elements related to food. And those are things that we feel like, you know, are progressively moving with each packet of baby food that we're able to provide back into our communities. Not only that, but being able to establish their palate at a very young age, those early crucial years of development in 0 to 5, where, you know, now we're setting a preference for healthy food, for the food that is, for foods that is of their own community, farmers, and, you know, those are things that you are able to experience now, as Beneath Agri-Foods has been able to really provide those types of markets for our communities here on the Navajo Reservation, and most importantly, options and opportunity.
And how much of, like, the 6,000 children you have provided, are they all regional or nearby, or what's the split in terms of your end consumers, which sounds really bad, your end customers, but the people that end up eating and benefiting from your baby food company? Is that all around you or also further away?
It is around us. They're from neighboring communities to communities within our own here on the Navajo Nation. And so what I guess for us to get those numbers is, we are part of a farm to school initiative / program through the state of New Mexico called the New Mexico Grown Coalition. And so from there, we're able to be a part of the food suppliers list, where we are then able to provide our foods to elder care, long-term age facilities and institutions, healthcare institutions, early childhood institutions, and being able to really increase our numbers through that route of markets.
And how would you describe your current line of foods for, of course, people that are not from your nation, as what part of your normal nutrition, your normal daily intake? Is it mostly focused on the breakfast side, on the snack, on dinner or lunch, or what kind of what kind of meals are you replacing in that sense for children and babies?
So for us, we're not, about replacing foods. We're about, adding in to your nutritional intake, and that's through the option that you do provide, and that's, the baby fruit cereal. And so the cereal is created out of an added value process of steaming our Navajo Indian white corn underground, and from there being able to dehydrate and process that, and then mill that down, and then package that for our consumers. And those are things that I feel like, people forget about those processes, and that's why, we're in today's diet agenda. We are so quick to, now you have access to healthy traditional food, now you need to stop eating hot Cheetos. But that's a part of our market. That's a part of our access, especially here on the Navajo Nation, where we have a grocery store every other 10,000 miles, 10,000 square footage in miles, and 10,000 square miles, you get, one grocery store. That, is a third in terms of more give access. And, you kind of wonder why we're in the predicament that we are in with the data of, type 2 diabetes. And so for us, the baby food cereal, you're able to boil that. After we dehydrate it and package it, you're able to rehydrate that into creating like a porridge, like a cereal, like a cream of wheat. Or you can use it as a flour additive in the same instance that you would use almond flour, for example. You can add in, baby foods or our corn cereal, or you can also mix it into some ingredients for baking. For ourselves, for example, on our Instagram page at Bitty Baby Foods, from there we were able to have recipes there on our website at bittybabyfoods.org, where we're able to make like a parfait, granola bar, being able to, for example, like meatloaf. My wife made a meatloaf instead of replacing the breadcrumbs with bitty baby foods, from that to like macarons, being able to make and incorporate the bitty baby foods a part of the recipe. Like it's a very versatile product. And that's something that we're looking to, because, you know, we were consumer minded, and especially consumers that are coming off the reservation where, you know, 30% of our people still don't have running water and electricity. And so, you know, those are things that we are accommodating through our product by making it friendly to their infrastructural needs, but also to price-wise as well. Very affordable product at $10. You know, we could easily charge more for how unique the product is in itself. But, you know, for us, we're not looking for a whole net profit. We're looking at the ability to continue to invest back into our community / farm. And that starts by understanding your community and how you want to market this product within your community. So those are a lot of the ways that this product is a part now as an option in our current food systems.
And you mentioned specifically on the website as well, and also before, the nutrition focus of the company and the nutrient density and the way that is connected, of course, with, of course, I'm saying it of course here, but that's because we're running a full series on that and done a lot of interviews around it, but the way it's connected to your farming principles or the practices you use and what results you get out of that. Is it something, that connection, healthy soil, healthy produce, healthy gut system, healthy people, that's something you see as a unique point of view as well, or you see something of like that it's getting more interest, let's say, from the end consumer, getting more interest from your customers, or is something that you clearly share on the website, but it's not the most important thing for the people that buy, that end up buy or purchase your produce? How important is nutrient density and flavor, of course, starting to become in your conversations you have and with your customers?
Oh gosh, this is a big question for us, because this is something that is a part of our mission, and being able to break down those systems of oppression by systemically rebuilding our food waste here on the Navajo Reservation, and by being able to relate the soil health with the households of our food that we provide to our community, and that's through the traditional practices. You know, regenerative agriculture is a sexy term that's being passed around nowadays, but that's something that as Indigenous people we have been doing since time immemorial. By having that relationship to the soil, by having that connection to the water and to the seeds, and being able to steward and nurture these elements, and being able to provide food by, you know, being able to understand your soil health. And that, those are things that I feel like, you know, we as Indigenous people have been doing for a very long time. It was something that was taught to me at a very young age in those valleys, of, you know, not ever having to rely on synthetic fertilizer or synthetic methods. And providing that to your people to eat, and the reason why we stick by these values and these principles so much is because you know, this is something that we're providing to our ceremonies, and you know, when we're out there and we're growing this corn, you know, we also go out there to collect the corn pollen. We collect that corn pollen because that pollen is life. That pollen is from the tops of the stalks, from those tassels, it falls down into the silk of the ears of corn, and that's when the reproduction cycle begins. And now we are part of that cycle of life for the corn and its seeds and the food that it may provide for our communities, and most importantly, our ceremonies. So in ceremonies, we use that pollen to offer back to our deities and to our elements, and synchronizing ourselves with the universe at dawn. Every morning, we'll take that pollen and we'll offer it to the east as we stand there waiting for sunrise. We'll do that there And then from there, we'll also, you know, do it in ceremony. And so through these cultural parts of these foods, this is how we are feeding our culture by establishing that connection to these elements and synchronizing ourselves as humans to be a part of that universe. And those are things that we forget, even in modern day regenerative practices. You know, we're so busy looking at the data and the science aspects of nutrient density, soil density, and health that we're forgetting about the spiritual components that make up that scientific conclusions and data. We can't measure spiritual data, but we can measure it through how we feel and I say that in regards to the innate tools that are inside of us as human beings. You know, we're so used to seeing things through a microscope, but you know, our eyes are one of the best optical tools, and not something that we cannot mimic. And so, you know, when we see things, when we feel things through that vision and that perspective, and we put aside some of those tools of today, so that way we can fire up our internal hard drive to then calculate and analyze that data and store it, and then continue to teach it and transfer it on over to future repositories, our culture repositories, and like our children. And that's how we see data. That's how we take care of our technical ecological knowledge, and being able to have that continuously practice on our farmlands and the food that we provide for our communities. And that is something so special to me, because that is something that our leaders have fought for. Our warriors and our ceremonial leaders that fought for the treaties of the 1864, when our Navajo people took the long walk to Bosco Redondo. And I bring up this history because during that time, our people suffered because they could not plant, they could not farm on the soil that they were encamped at. And that was intentional, because the U.S. government knew we as Navajo people, Diné people, lived an agrarian lifestyle. We had to live with water, good soil, and seeds, but they didn't provide any of that. So because of that, we became reliant on the commodity foods that the U.S. government was then providing for our people. So our leaders fought hard, both physically and advocatively, to be able to get us in it. Yeah, and to get us into the position that we are at now, with having one of the largest Indian reservations in the nation, but also a reservation that is connected to the San Juan River, the Colorado River. Chief Barbancito fought for that right to have access to water. You know, they wanted to migrate us down south more, but you know, they all fought for us to be in the place that we are at, because he knew our people, our culture, and our ceremonies would not live past 100 years if they did not have access to that water. And so, you know, once we got access to that water, he said, now my children will be able to live and see to each horizon green growth of corn. On the eastern horizon, the southern horizon, the western horizon, the northern horizon. In each direction that you'll see prosperity with the green of the corn that is grown on our lands now. So with that prosperity, may we live a happy, peaceful life. And those are things that are documented in the treaties that were signed during that time. And so because of that, each acre that we farm, corn seed that we save and feed our children, that is an answer to that prayer. But also, most importantly, that living prayer is now being established and by being able to continue to protect those water and land rights to this day. So that, for us as Meeting Baby Foods, that's how we see regenerative agriculture. That's how we see breaking down in cycles of oppression and systemic changes that have happened to us with First Contact. And being able to continue to heal our communities and rebuild that generational wealth that was severed with first contact.
Wow, first of all, and there's so many things to unpack there, but I would love to start. I mean, it sounds, of course, the position you're in now compared to what it could have been is very different. But at the same time, you're mentioning you cannot build any physical infrastructure and owning it. And like, there's still a lot to break down. But I wanted to ask a different question. And like you mentioned, regen ag or regenerative agriculture now is a sexy term. And obviously comes from, or like indigenous peoples like yourself have been doing this for centuries, or as long as we know. How does it make you feel? Like suddenly the hipness and suddenly everybody, not everybody, but it seems like everybody, of course, in our bubble, and we talk about it all the time in the podcast, seems to be talking about soil and the connection and the practices and plowing and all of that, but definitely not all of the spiritual and cultural part you mentioned. How does it make you feel, all the new people to the party, let's say?
I say welcome. It's
a bit late, but yeah, welcome.
Yeah. And I think that's something that has been, we've been working towards as Western farmers and agriculturalists, of being able to completely understand their relationship to these new lands that they now reside on.
That's an amazing statement. The new lands that they now reside on. Yeah, I was reading somewhere, I don't remember which article, but it seems like we, and I'm definitely using the we here of non-Indigenous people, we still seem to be with one foot on the boat, like when we came with first contact, and with one foot on land. We haven't really decided yet if we're going to stay for a long time. And that shows in our actions, which I found a very nice way of putting that. And we're still figuring out our relationship to the land and haven't been really listening, I think, very well.
Yeah, and that's something that, we need more of, is, more listeners, like you said, like being able to completely understand and listen to not only each other, but the land and what it can provide for us and the opportunity that it may give if you work with it. If you don't work with it, it will not give those opportunities to you. And that's something that is a huge example of all of what I'm talking about is, the Dust Bowl that happened in Midwestern, United States, where, Western methods of agriculture turned healthy soil that they took from indigenous people and thinking that, oh, if they can do it, we can do it, but we're going to do it our way. And look what happened. And they paid for it. They paid, and they're still paying for it to this day. And so, those are things that we have seen. For example, a really good example that I love to bring into this art is that, the buffalo that they annihilated and almost, became extinct due to the scorched earth trials. The U.S. government knew that the indigenous people relied on the buffalo, and the buffalo relied on the people. So they could only take one out of the equation, and that was the buffalo. And so with that, the buffalo saliva is what provides those ancestral seeds and grasses to be able to grow healthy on those lands, especially on the prairie. And those are things that they understood, that they studied and researched, and that's how they were able to, get the people to do what they needed by controlling the buffalo. So examples like that, and being able to continue to heal to this day from such genocide, I feel like now we're able to move forward in that direction now with the ability of like the EQIP grant that's provided by the USDA, these regenerative agricultural practices that everybody is understanding now that they want to be able to provide a future for their children to farm and grow on. So those are some heavy examples that I bring to the table that I feel like, we forget about as modern day regenerative agriculturalists.
Yeah, and also I would almost add modern day scientists as well. If we understood at that time the importance of the buffalo, we're sort of rediscovering now how important that keystone species was and is. And now with a lot of work, we're trying to bring back 1% of the 1% of the numbers. And it's an enormous effort to restore a very small piece of the depth and of the enormous traumas that we caused, of course. And switching gears to a second, because you said we need to listen much better. This morning when you were waiting for the sunrise, what did you hear?
Well, I think...
if you want to share, of course.
Yeah, to be comical, I heard this morning my children, wanting juice, wanting breakfast, wanting to eat. So, those are things that, we have to continue to contribute and grow for our children in that sense. So for me, I hear those prayers being spoken, but not answered. So what can we do as, again, parents, providers, farmers, to be able to provide for that and answer those types of prayers that are well talked about every morning or within ceremonial settings, and being able to feel our community?
And what do you see, if at all, but what do you see, if yes, as a role for money in this transition? And of course, in this podcast, we talk about investments very broadly. It could be a lot of different things, but definitely also financial investments, or at least money investments, to unlock certain things, to speed up certain things. But we also know how destructive the tool of money can be, just like fire and potentially bison and other, if not managed or if not respected and if not facilitated well. And so coming back to the money piece, what do you see the role of money in this, if we can call it regenerative transition?
Yeah, so I love this question a lot because, this one was talking about like being able to use colonial systems and being able to continue traditional life ways.
if that tension, that's the dance we dance in this podcast. Like, can we somehow use all that zeros and the zeros we've created to speed up healing?
Yes.
Or not. Maybe there's the answer. It could be like, just forget about it.
And that's something
I would love to know your
angle. And shifting gears, like you said, like that's something that we are very good at as Indigenous peoples, adapting to our current environments and conditions. And with that, adapting to now, we need to be a part of these systems. We need to be a part of, by contributing to capitalism, we got to pay our taxes. with that, we also have the ability to control our business model and how we're able to have that approach looking at a social capacity building rather than an individual one, or, being able to have a non-capitalistic approach where we're not looking to, collect every penny that we can from our communities that are also impoverished. And so for myself, personal experience, like I grew up pinching pomos, I grew up on SNAP, ADT, Women, Infant, and Children benefit programs provided by the government. Like being able to be a part of this, I guess, ways of growing up, I felt like, what can we do to not continue those cycles of hardship back into our communities? And that was something that I felt like was important through by building this generational wealth. Like for me, the only thing that I can inherit from my parents is land use permits, grazing rights, but not, a 401k or not a savings account or something that will help me to propel, if I wanted to, education, my current business, investment into my children's savings accounts for their college education. These are things that we're thinking about now as parents, Mary and myself. And that's something that needs to be provided for their future, because that's the type of environment and system that they will grow up in. And so with that, for us, we have a hybrid business model. We have an LLC, Bini Dairy Foods LLC, and we have a 501c3 called the BEN Initiative. BEN is an acronym for Birth, Environment, and Nutrition. So through the hybrid business model, we are able to apply for grant funding, use and get in philanthropy money, get in donations through our 501c3 that can then immediately be put into programming where we are teaching these values. We are teaching these agricultural practices, traditional agricultural practices back into our community, build capacity and bring the education and awareness to why healthy traditional foods are important for our communities. And that's, you know, by collaborating with local entities. One great example is Tumbleweed Nutrition LLC, who is Danae Bex, and she has an RD. She is an RD and a registered dietitian. Like being able to collaborate and create events that are around, you know, where we have an event. We had an event a month ago where it's called Corn Pollen to Cuisine, where we as Little Baby Foods will go out and teach the community how to collect and harvest pollen, the cultural significance to that. And Danae was doing a cooking class and recipe development and curriculum development of, you know, why, you know, this nutritional intake is important, but also how you can include it to everyday plates. And so with that approach, we are healing our community in that sense, and not shaming them to say you should not be eating spam. We should not be eating fried bread. You know, those are things we're setting those examples now by teaching our children here and now on the farm while we collect corn pollen and eat healthy food together. And so those are the components we bring to your table by having this hybrid business model. And then the LLC side of things is using that revenue where we can then invest into equipment, heavy equipment, like, you know, tractors, seeds, shovels, you know, different tools that we may need for the farm to help us maintain it. So that way we're not having to think about, oh, we're going to need this many pounds of synthetic soil fertilizer, or we're going to need to bring in some herbicide. We don't have to ever think in that direction because we're able to use that revenue that we have been saving because of the offset costs that the 501c3 provides for the business, that we're able to move in that innovative, forward-thinking direction that will be a just, green future for our children to thrive in, not survive in.
And what if we would flip the conversation in that sense and put you in the driver's seat of a relatively large, I mean, it's a lot of money for any standards, but somehow in this world, it seems like not so much anymore because we get the billions thrown around constantly. Not many people have them, obviously. But if you would be in charge of $1 billion to put to work, we could argue if it's good to have such a concentration in one person's hand, but let's put that aside for another podcast. But let's say it's the case and you wake up tomorrow morning and that's the case, but you have to put it to work. I'm not asking for dollar amounts. I'm asking what would be your priorities? What would you focus on first if you had almost unlimited, let's say, financial resources? What would be your main area of attention? Where would you put most of the money to be put to work, and how would you do that?
So I think one special thing that I would say towards from my dad's soul was when I was growing up, I would always see all these problems within my community, and I would tell my dad as we were driving by, "Dad, they should do this, they should do that, they should fix this. How come they don't buy this and, you know, fix this?" And he's like, we're talking together. He's looks at me and like, "Son, who's they?" I looked at him and I was like, I don't know, but, you know, people, politicians and, you know, like leaders. And he's like, "Well, yeah." And he was like, they're obviously not doing anything right now because we are in the position that we are at, unfortunately. But if you use the farm, if you use these values that I've taught you, then why don't you be the they? You can be the they, son." And I looked at him and was like, "That's right." So here we are, about 20 years later, thinking about that. And, you know, that's what we're providing for our community now. That's what we're providing for our children by establishing these opportunities, by using that farm. And using that farm as a huge opportunity for our children to grow up and understand and have that relationship to the land, but most importantly, how to steward it, how to take care of it, how to take care of investments. Because grants are investments into capacity building, into program implementation and development. So all of that investment is being taken care of. And we're teaching that to our children now, who grew up in cycles of financial illiteracy and not having availability to resources or opportunities related to economic development and growth. We don't have an economic development center dedicated to our youth or specific communities that, for example, our agriculture community in the Northwest region of New Mexico, we don't have an economic development center there. If we were to put remote centers like that where we can take the youth, teach them financial literacy, teach them capacity building, workforce development, and have access to the land and water, you know, because for us, we're farming on 15 acres. If we had $1 billion, we could invest into so much more across the Navajo Nation and protect our water rights and land rights through that investment, rather than thinking about, oh, I wish we could do this, I wish we could do that. But what makes us unique in this question is that, you know, instead of waiting for $1 billion, we're doing it here, now, today. We have already finished successful projects yesterday. Now we're planning today and investing, continuing to invest into our future. So for us, we're building that $1 billion. We're building up, and those are things that we're thinking about now. Is, you know, I'm tired. I was tired of wishing for $1 million or $1 billion to drop into my pocket, but I have to work for it. I have to advocate for it, and most importantly, I have to save for it and invest all of that back into my community of agriculture, and that way my children have that generational wealth to fall back on, but most importantly, and grow it. So that way, and that's why I talk to you know, the guards of, you know, building you know, a future where our children are not going to survive in, but thrive in. And that's what we're building now. And that's how, if and eventually $1 billion does happen, that's the type of future that we're envisioning.
And as a final question, which usually ends up being more questions, but if you had the, I like to call it the magic wand question. So if you had the power to change one thing, could be on a global level, could be, you know, consciousness, could be better taste, could be people have said end all agriculture subsidies, people have said make Roundup illegal, anything you can possibly imagine. What would it be? But one thing only. What would you change tomorrow morning, or what would you change overnight?
Yeah, if I had a magic wand, I think the one thing that I would change is the ability to have access to our land. And that land is our lifeline. That land is who we are culturally, ceremonially. And those are things that I feel like if we were to own our land 100%, not 80%, not 50%, 100%, then those opportunities would continue to arise. And our ceremonies and culture will begin to flourish even more. That's my magic wand. And that's coming from a person who, you know, has gone through and survived a lot of hardship. But, you know, the land is your connection to your ceremony, a connection to your inner self. And with that, we'll continue to heal yourself and your community, and ultimately teach these values and continue on. And that's where I see opportunity, and that's where I want that opportunity really lying. So that's all. Policy, money, it's that connection to the land that you reside on.
It's a perfect question to answer to this question, and also a great way to wrap up. this conversation. I want to thank you so much for taking time in this, in your very busy, busy early days of your second child, and of course, very busy days in terms of the company and the nonprofit. And thank you so much for sharing your work, sharing your passion, and sharing your reasoning why and how you're building this, the impact you're having. So thank you so much for coming on. And of course, thank you for the amazing work you're doing.
Thank you for giving us the ability to share our voice and share our initiatives, and most importantly, seeing how others can get on board. So for our listeners, you know, we invite you to come on out to the farm and experience what we're experiencing on an everyday basis. So please reach out on our email, reach out on our website at biddybabyfoods.org, and we'd be happy to host you with your hands and seeing how we can continue to work for a prospering future for our children. Thank you.
Yeah, and I will put all the links, obviously, in the show notes below, so you can have a look. Follow them on Instagram, follow their newsletters. And if you're in the area or you want to travel, definitely go and visit and spend some proper time, quality time on the land to listen and to see with your own eyes and all the other senses what true regeneration looks and feels like.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you liked this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.